Can the post office raise rates again? It could find out today.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, good morning. I'm Bill Radke. Today is the end of the government's fiscal year, and there is no new budget yet from Congress. Late yesterday, lawmakers voted to extend government spending until December. One issue they're looking at, out of many, is funding for the Postal Service, which is waiting to hear today on its request to raise the price of a first-class stamp from 44 to 46 cents to head off a growing budget crisis. Marketplace's John Dimsdale is with us live from Washington, D.C. Hi, John.
Good morning, Bill.
Is the post office going broke?
Well, it ran a deficit of nearly $4 billion last year and is on track to lose another $7 billion this year. And all that's despite a 20% decline in the volume of mail, thanks to the internet and private deliveries, and also despite cutting 36,000 jobs over the past couple of years.
So they're cutting jobs, John. Why does the Postal Service also need this rate increase way above inflation?
Well, that depends on who you ask. People in the Postal Service say they're stuck with too many post offices, usually named for politicians, by the way, and forced to deliver lots of junk mail, even on Saturdays, for very little money. But lawmakers and people who use the service say the post office refuses to make tough decisions to lay off unneeded workers and stop paying lavish salaries and pension benefits. But of more immediate concern is a warning from the post office that it's going to run out of cash sometime next month. Congress punted on that question. The post office wants permission to skip a required payment to its employee pension fund, and it wants to stop Saturday deliveries. Those issues will have to come back before Congress after the election.
Marketplace's John Dimsdale, thanks.
Thanks, Bill.
The future of a massive New York City apartment complex is a little clearer this week after a state appeals court ruled that a foreclosure sale will go forward. The $5.5 billion sale of this development 4 years ago kind of marked the peak of the real estate bubble. Now the property is said to be worth less than half that. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Stuyvesant Town and Peter Cooper Village occupy 80 acres on the east side of Manhattan. Some 25,000 people live there.
And it's been a middle-class housing oasis, really, since 1947.
That's Al Doyle, president of the Tenants Association. Earlier this year, the owners of that oasis defaulted on billions of dollars in loans. Two groups of lenders have been battling for control. This week's court ruling clears the way for one of those groups to sell the complex. Economist Sam Shandon with Real Capital Analytics says the sale could be a bellwether for the recovering commercial real estate market.
Strong valuation, I think, could help to bolster what already is a positive underlying trend for the apartment sector in the United States.
Tenants are hoping for a deal that allows some of them to buy their apartments at affordable prices and others to stay on as renters. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Let's do the numbers. Stocks are lower in Asia and Europe this morning. It doesn't help that Moody's Investors Service is the latest credit rating agency to downgrade Spain's debt. On Wall Street yesterday, the Dow Industrials slipped 22 points, that's 0.2%, to settle at 10,835.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Constant Contact Email Marketing, providing small businesses and nonprofits with personal coaches to help them succeed. ConstantContact.com. By LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. And by the new Rosetta Stone, introducing their latest advancement in language learning, version 4 Totali. Information at rosettastone.com/APM.
What do you think of when I say Basil? A cantankerous B&B proprietor in a British comedy? That's a good answer. But if you said Basel III is a new set of international banking rules, I'm really impressed. My old friend David Brancaccio has been studying Basel III as part of a new beat on Marketplace called Economy 4.0, about the quest for a better financial system. David, welcome.
Glad to be here.
So I know that world leaders are set to ratify the new Basel banking rules later this fall. I also know that bank rules are deathly boring, correct?
au contraire. Actually, you know, there's a fascinating paradox for those of us who are not bankers for a living. On the one hand, Basel might avert the need for another bank bailout, always nice, yet the rules encourage stability by making banks hold on to more of their capital, which some worry could make them less likely to lend money to you and me.
How do these new rules work?
It's a way to force banks to have a thicker mattress stuffed with cash and other easy-to-access capital. Now, it's not good enough to have assets. They have to be more of the kind a bank can quickly use if a bunch of creditors show up wanting their money.
And how are those rules going over so far?
Well, I spoke with the experts about this, the great and the good, but some of the most useful wisdom I got was from a small businessman. Kelly Conklin runs a cabinet-making company in Jersey. These Basel folks adjusting capital reserves is all well and good, he says. But what about times like now, when lending is frustratingly tight?
But I think we have to go back and think about the way banks think. They're going to have to change the way they think as well. They can't just adjust it mechanically. They're going to have to just adjust it somewhat philosophically. They're going to have the flexibility of mind at the bottom to see that the way out of the bottom is to make this credit available. It's not so much about reserves per se as it is about how you use those reserves.
In the U.S., the Federal Reserve controls this, so maybe flexibility will come that way.
David, I want to know, why do you care so much about this stuff?
Well, this new marketplace, Economy 4.0 Beat, is about tracking efforts to re-engineer the financial system and to look at whether or not it can be made to better serve more people, like, for instance, Mr. Conklin, who we just heard from. Some say Basel is the biggest international response yet to how the banking system can be fixed, and I think we should monitor these new rules of the road.
We'll be monitoring this stuff together. Marketplace's special correspondent, David Brancaccio, thank you.
My pleasure.
And finally, researchers may have found a new source of biofuel, the cups used by the Canadian coffee shop chain Tim Hortons. According to University of Manitoba scientists, Tim Hortons cups, when shredded and ground, are hospitable to fuel-producing bacteria in a way that, say, Starbucks cups are not. Interesting. Look for that new ad campaign. Tim Hortons, more hospitable to bacteria than Starbucks. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.